bullets penetrated his body, he switched the ammo amid clash and kept shooting. Zionists drowned him with bullets. The body that had exhausted an entire army, which had been searching for him throughout 264 hours of pursuit, finally calmed down and transcended to eternal peace. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Daniel Yegic, academic and political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us, Dr. Yegic. Now, such an important scene that we all witnessed last week, but in his will, martyr Uday al-Tamimi, he wrote down on a torn piece of paper, "My operation in Shafat was a drop in the roaring sea of struggle. Although such an effort will not liberate Palestine, the fruit of the process, according to his description, will mobilize hundreds of young people who will carry my gun and my body. This will touch the heart of every free soul in the world." But do you think, did it mean anything for Zionist Israel?
Yeah, so the martyr's act of resistance was obviously a reaction to the structural terrorism, Israeli terrorism that Palestinians have been exposed to for decades, and in particular, of course, in the last days and weeks, the heightened oppression and on top of the structural oppression in the West Bank. I think what we've seen in the last days happening in Palestine is that his words have inspired many to take to the streets and to continue their resistance against this colonial and genocidal regime. Now, the question what this actually means for the Zionist regime, I think we can see that, again, the Zionist regime is scared. It's another moment of fear for the settler regime because it displays the continuity of the Palestinian resistance, to which the Zionists generally react with even more measures that are harsh in terms of fragmenting the population, establishing checkpoints, controlling their movements. But none of this, of these actions of this nuclear-armed first world superpower to that extent have actually managed to silence Palestinian resistance. And this latest case showed once again how these words have inspired more people to take to the streets. So I think it's another moment of fear for the settler, especially if we again go back to the situation of settler colonialism, which in its structure is genocidal. The settler regime cannot sustain itself without violence and cannot exist, coexist with the indigenous population. So what the Israeli regime needs is more continuous violence that will, of course, cause more resistance. So in this case, anything Palestinians actually have to do to become a threat to the Zionists is stay at home, let alone actually perform acts of resistance that destabilize the Zionist enemy.
But I mean, Danielle, for 10 days, the Zionist Israeli entity and its intelligence system was driven by hysteria generated by their failure to find the young hero Uday al-Tamimi, who stormed the Shafat checkpoint on October 8th. Attacked an enemy soldier and killed a female soldier before he just withdrew in peace without being touched. That was the fourth occupation soldier killed in 1 month in occupied Palestine. What has changed in Palestine, and where do you think this is headed?
Yes, so recently the Zionist regime has increased its killing of the Palestinian population. This year alone, over 170 Palestinians were killed, including an average one Palestinian a day this month in the West Bank alone. The Zionist regime has increased its checkpoints, its restrictions on the freedom of movement of Palestinians. So the reactions of Palestinians are obviously legitimate forms of resistance against this regime. And it shows again how nervous the colonizer is about the response of the indigenous population, in particular because many people have taken to the street as a response to the settler terrorism that settlers in the West Bank are attacking Palestinians, being backed by the mainstream institutions of the Zionist enemy and the complicity of, as many argue, the Palestinian Authority as a colonial instrument of the Zionist regime, and of course the lack of any international law or mechanism that would protect Palestinians from the state terrorism that they are subjected to. So of course these are legitimate reactions of resistance, but again they show that the Zionist regime has to come up time and time again with new forms of control and containment effectively continue oppressing Palestinians. And these responses have increased recently, as we've seen with people taking to the street and again putting and questioning all of these, destabilizing the power structures that the Zionist apartheid regime has been imposing.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you about, because without any warning, without any decision, we just saw Palestinians flocking the streets in many cities across the occupied villages and the refugee camps in the occupied West Bank and in occupied Al-Quds as well, after announcing that Udaya Tamimi was martyred. The entire West Bank experienced confrontations at many levels. It began in Shafat, it continued to Al-Quds, and then we saw thousands of young men gathering in front of the house of Uday's family, trying to show support for the family, and massive rallies took also part. These Palestinians took part in protests in Jenin, in Al-Khalil, Hebron in the south, and they headed even to very risky, let's say, frontline points and military checkpoints of the Israeli occupation forces. This reminds us of the Intifada of Palestine. Are we on the verge of a third Intifada in occupied Palestine?
Yeah, I think the events that you pointed to obviously indicate that there is a stronger and broader sort of frustration, I would even say, from the occupied population, obviously going against the occupier. And again, it also shows the continuity of Palestinian resistance. And despite the fact that a Zionist occupier has employed all means at her disposal to not only oppress, but also to fragment Palestinians physically into enclaves in the West Bank, to restrict communication within Palestine among Palestinians, it has not managed to prevent Palestinians from taking to the streets and from protesting in all these different forms, which again is a very a legitimate form of resistance. Palestinians have the right to take up arms and any means at their disposal to fight and to protect themselves against this terrorism. And yeah, the situation could definitely increase and lead to another form of what is oftentimes considered as an intifada, even though, of course, at the same time, many Palestinians say that the intifada and these actions of resistance are a continuity and are something that takes place continuously and is not necessarily restricted to a particular time frame. But it does indicate that the frustration is resulting again in different forms of protest against the Zionist colonizer.
Even different forms of new resistance, like the Lion's Den, for example. What are your thoughts about that in less than a minute?
Exactly. So it's obviously a current moment that has received a lot of support throughout historic Palestine from Palestinians in different regions of Palestine who went to the street to show their solidarity and support, and just shows again how effective and effectively organized the resistance is and how it is connected to its land and the idea of the liberation, and again shows the strength of it as opposed to the colonizer that is continues to be a colonial outpost. And here's, I think, again where the strength of the resistance and its goal towards liberation lies.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Daniel Yagich, academic and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this new wave of Palestinian generation that is adamant on fighting the occupation and liberating their lives and their land. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Daniel, and please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Sana'a is preventing others from looting Yemeni oil.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Ansarullah declared it plainly. Yemeni oil and gas cannot be allowed to go to Europe or any other country while the Yemeni people are suffering from a gas and oil crisis. Hence why Yemen's armed forces announced on the 21st of October carrying out a warning drone strike on Al-Dabba port of Hadramaut in order to prevent a Greek tanker, the Nissos Kea, from looting oil from the facility. The warning message came after addressing the authorities of that ship and informing them of the decision based on Yemeni laws. The ship was then dealt with through cautionary measures, through which Ansarullah were keen to preserve the safety of its crew and the security of Yemen's infrastructure while making sure that the Yemeni oil stays inside Yemen. Sana'a prevents looting of Yemeni oil in this following report.
Sana'a carried out its first warnings to shipping companies operating in transporting Yemeni crude oil from governorates outside its control by targeting a Greek ship that approached the port of Al-Daba and violated Ansarullah's warnings. After a former Greek ship left Yemeni territorial waters in the Arabian Sea last week due to warnings, another ship called the Nisos risked entering towards the Daba oil port, located in the administrative framework of the Ashehr district east of Mukalla, the capital of the Hadramaut governorate in the east of the country. According to informed Yemeni sources, the Greek ship has been parked in international waters for about a week after receiving promises of protection from the Ministry of Transport in the government in Yemen's south, aimed at loading 2 million barrels of Yemeni crude oil. According to navigation monitoring, the ship entered the Yemeni waters in the Arabian Sea at dawn on Friday and approached the Daba port, and upon its arrival, the port was attacked at exactly 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. According to the statement of the governor of Hadramaut, loyal to the Saudi coalition of aggression, Mabhout bin Mahdi, the operation was carried out by drones, the first targeting the area separating the port and the submersible in which the ship was anchored, and minutes later another attack was carried out on the pavement of the port. According to bin Mahdi, Sana'a had issued warnings to the Greek Ministry of Transport not to approach the Yemeni territorial waters, which was conveyed to the ship's crew. After the strike, the ship withdrew out of the Yemeni territorial waters. As a result, Petromasila stopped pumping oil from the Masila oil facility to the port, and all its workers were evacuated from the port. All official roads leading to the Adaba oil port in the Ashehr district were also closed down by the security authorities, and a security and military emergency was declared in the Daba axis, which follows orders from the coalition of aggression. Spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, confirmed later in a brief military statement that Sana'a carried out the attack and said, "We carried out a simple warning strike to prevent an oil ship that was trying to loot crude oil through the port of Al-Daba in Hadramaut Governorate." Saria confirmed that the oil ship violated the decision issued by the Yemeni authorities to ban the transportation and export of Yemeni sovereign oil derivatives, and indicated that the warning message came to prevent the continuation of the looting of oil wealth and not to privatize it to serve the people in salaries and services. Saria explained that the ship was dealt with in accordance with Yemeni laws and international law, with cautionary measures through which Ansarullah were keen to preserve the safety and security of Yemen's infrastructure and the security of the ship and its crew. Ansarullah's warning operation was directed to all ships operating in the field of transporting Yemeni crude oil, which Sana'a accuses of the government loyal to the coalition of looting about 20 million barrels since 2016, and calls for linking crude oil sales to the payment of the salaries of civil and military state employees without exception.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Murad, researcher, columnist, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces spokesperson, Brigadier General Yahya Saria, said that the Yemeni Armed Forces carried out what he called a simple warning strike in order to prevent an oil ship that was carrying or trying to carry crude oil through the port of Al-Daba and Hadramaut Governorate. Oil that is meant by Sana'a to pay the salaries of employees, whether civil or military ones, for their salaries to be paid, which is basically the main issue right now inside of Yemen. Do you think that Ansarullah will be able, by doing so, to control the crude oil that is being looted out of Yemen?
There is no doubt that this step taken by Sana'a, as per what Brigadier General Yahya Saria announced, was an anticipated step given the media speeches that were propagated by Sana'a throughout the recent weeks. This media speech was one of a warning tone against the coalition of aggression countries and Western countries, on top of which is the United States of America, who were looting the Yemeni oil at such a cheap price. Sana'a was clear that this looting process has to stop and will be made to stop. This was evident by the warnings issued by Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who said that in light of the unjustified blockade that Sana'a and all governorates under the capital's authority, it is no longer acceptable nor allowed for the Yemeni oil and gas to be looted the way things have been going since before 2015. When Sana'a issued those threats, it leaned on its actual operational and political capacity to execute those threats. Past experiences indicate that every time Sana'a issues a threat or announces a new equation of military engagement, it always executes what it had promised to do. Sana'a has already proven its seriousness when it comes to its project towards liberation from regional and international hegemony. Restoring rights and deterring the coalition of aggression that has been colluding against the Yemeni people since before 2015. Ansarullah fully enjoy the operational abilities, and it is absolutely true what Brigadier Sari' said. He said that this attack on Hadramaut was just a message, and truly was so. Sana'a made sure that none of the Daba port workers were injured as a result of the drone attacks. You see, if Sana'a wanted to inflict injuries against any civilian workers, it would have done so in its previous attacks. A proof of that is when Sana'a sent drone attacks to the Saudi Aramco oil facility in Abqiq in September 2019, where the targets were extremely accurate and no civilian was killed at the time, despite the fact that the attack back then was a huge one. This means that Ansarullah possesses the professional and practical ability to execute exactly what they promise against the coalition of aggression or the mercenaries that are loyal to the aggression south of Yemen.
But today we see that Yemen is imposing, or the Yemeni capital here, Sana'a, is imposing a new equation, which is oil for government salaries. But although this attack is local, meaning it happened inside Yemeni land, isn't this also considered an escalation against the coalition of aggression countries, which basically allows these international crude oil ships to enter Yemeni territorial waters in Hadramaut, for example, while they suffocate Hudaydah port and they do not even allow humanitarian aid to enter through Hudaydah port?
Well, formally, who is supposedly controlling and managing the Yemen oil facilities is the so-called legitimacy government of Yemen, or the Presidential Council south of Yemen. But practically, the side who controls the foreign oil contracts and the side who receive the foreign oil ships who docks in Hadramaut to loot and export Yemen's oil is basically the UAE and Saudi Arabia. The UAE in particular, especially in the oil of Shabwa and Hadramaut. This means that this new deterrence equation that was initiated by Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and this is being executed by the Yemeni armed forces, is an equation that is, yes, addressed for the coalition of aggression. Sana'a calculated in precision the step that it took in Hadramaut, and the timing of this attack was very well planned, in light of a similar experience that took place on the eastern part of the Mediterranean, with the equation that was initiated by Hezbollah to deter the Zionist entity and to restore Lebanon's maritime rights from the hands of the Americans and the Zionists. Hezbollah, along with the official Lebanese government, were successful in that file. Hence, Sana'a knows very well that there is a current international condition that suits Yemen to reclaim its rights in oil and gas derivatives. The West in general, and the US and Europe in specific, are in dire need of any oil shipment that comes from any part of the world. Which is why the timing of announcing this new deterrent equation was very clever, because Ansarullah will now impose their rightful demands on the coalition of aggression and the West too, meaning the US and Europe specifically, because there are European oil companies operating inside Yemen, looting Yemeni oil, like, for example, the French Total Company. Hence, there is somewhat of an intersection between what happened in the Lebanese maritime demarcation file to secure its oil and gas rights, and now the Yemeni right in their own oil and gas fields. The same companies and the same international parties are present in both Lebanon and Yemen, which Yemen is trying today to deter and to restore their rights from.
But doesn't this actually put out a preliminary maybe escalation to another possible wave of attacks against Saudi oil facilities inside Saudi Arabia? And if so, if Yemen will go out on another wave of attacks, how will Saudi Arabia handle these attacks in light of the global demand for crude oil production?
Well, the world is witnessing a new conflict between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States of America concerning the price of oil and the percentage of crude oil production as per the decision taken by OPEC plus countries. Meanwhile, in Yemen, after the passing of October 2, which was the date that was supposed to witness the renewal of the ceasefire treaty between Yemen and the coalition of aggression. However, no truce renewal was announced, hence all options are on the table. Last week, the deterrence equation was restricted to the Yemeni land against foreign companies looting Yemeni oil. However, I believe in the event of the tenacity of the coalition of aggression to achieve the demands of the Yemenis, then maybe the deterrence equation will expand to include oil facilities in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. This is a very critical matter for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the event Yemeni missiles and drones return to targeting Saudi oil facilities. This will constitute a big problem for Mohammed bin Salman, especially when the US is looking to reassess its relationship with the Saudis as a result of the OPEC Plus decisions, which in turn will lead to an increase in the price of oil production. This is something that the West does not want to see happen, and this will eventually further complicate the problematic situation between Mohammed bin Salman and the West. At this moment, Yemen has a golden opportunity to restore its rights through openly threatening Saudi oil facilities in the event Yemenis do not benefit from the oil that is being stolen out of their own land.
So definitely it's an opportunity the same way it was for Lebanon with the Zionist entity. It is an opportunity right now for Yemen when it comes to Saudi Arabia. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, researcher and political commentator, for joining us to talk about what's going on in Yemen, which, by the way, ladies and gents, happens to be not followed by the Western mainstream media, which is why you see it right here, because we give you what the West never does. Thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. Last night, as part one of this mini two-part subtopic discussion, part two being tonight, we talked about the components of an Islamic identity. And yesterday we talked about the I-ness and the who-ness inside of us. Ultimately, the identity is an answer of who are you. And I mentioned that that answer sometimes will fluctuate. And so having multiple dimensions of one identity is nothing that we should be a little bit too excited about. As I mentioned, depending on who's asking you who you are, you'll give the relevant answer. All of that is part of your identity. But within Islam now, the foundational principle is this immaterial soul of ours. The I inside of me. If you remember the example I gave of the physical fluctuating state of our existence from when I was a newborn to now. But the one constant, the one unifying factor, of course, is me. That now needs to be built, needs to be strengthened, needs to be cleansed. Needs to be veiled from the dangers of any society. And that brings me to part number two of this discussion. The Quran now invites us towards the idea of making sure that your internal kingdom is cleansed. And in so doing, in doing so now, you end up now attaining victory and success. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. Now, one area that I think sometimes people like me underestimate the impact it has on me are my thoughts. Okay? So I want to speak tonight about thoughts and the power of thoughts. Because if we want to now build this identity towards a God-centric lens, you'll be surprised, I'll be surprised, how much power we have in the way that we think. And sometimes, literally, we can change the way I think, I can change the way I act. To start off with, there is a beautiful hadith Qudsi that's narrated by Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. And my entire purpose tonight is to, especially my young guys, is to make all of you understand that what you allow to enter your thoughts, don't underestimate the power that has on you. Now, alhamdulillah, we are blessed. It's Allah's grace that we are not questioned by how we think. If we were, oh baby, thank God. Sometimes you don't want to know what's in my head. Instead, Allah now will say, what is the power by which you converted that thought into action and amal? That's where, of course, there'll be a sense of accountability. It doesn't mean that we simply allow everything and anything access to our mind. Inshallah, later on, I'll talk about a little bit of the triggers of a thought. But first, let's bring the point home with a couple of ahadithes, a few beautiful statements, and then inshallah, some discussions. Now, the Hadith al-Qudsi says, it's a very famous one. It's an incredible one. And the chain is what I want really for all of you to focus on with me. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَمَنْ قَسَدَنِي عَرَفَنِي وَمَنْ عَرَفَنِي أَرَادَنِي وَمَنْ أَرَادَنِي طَلَبَنِي وَمَنْ طَلَبَنِي وَجَدَنِي وَمَنْ وَجَدَنِي خَدَمَنِي وَمَنْ خَدَمَنِي ذَكَرَنِي وَمَنْ ذَكَرَنِي ذَكَرْتُهُ بِرَحْمَتِي. Beautiful hadith. Let's break it down bit by bit. He says, all Allah now, Allah's talking. Hadith al-Qudsi are those words of Allah that you don't find in the Quran. So not the Imam, not some Sahabi of the Imam or the Prophet of Allah. Qala Allah. Allah has said, the one who has qasd of me. It's those words I find tough to translate. The one who has an inclination towards me, an initial spark of a thought towards me. The one now who begins now to move towards me is qasd. Right? Some people say niyat. It's an okay translation. More so is the fact that you wake up one day and you have this thought that I'm going to move towards Allah. Allah says the one who has that initial thought, arafani, has a certain level of ma'arifat of me. You don't move towards things that you don't know. You don't move towards the unknown. You move towards those things that you are well aware of. وَمَنْ عَرَفَنِي أَرَادَنِي. And the one who has ma'arifat of me, he has this will towards me. She has this desire towards me. She has this irada towards me. Irada is a conscious decision to do something. Right? It's also irada is also in Urdu as well. Right? When you have irada, it means that, you know what, this is what I'm planning to do. It's quite strong now. وَمَنْ أَرَادَنِي طَلَبَنِي. The one who has this will towards me looks for me, searches for me. وَمَنْ طَلَبَنِي وَجَدَنِي. The one who looks for me finds me, Allah says. The one who looks for me finds me. That statement alone is enough for our life. The one who looks for me finds me. وَمَنْ وَجَدَنِي خَدَمَنِي. Once you found me, he says, you serve me. You do khidmat of me. Allah says, you only serve me when you find me. وَمَنْ خَدَمَنِي ذَكَرَنِي. One who serves me remembers me. Does dhikr of me. Doesn't forget me. وَمَنْ ذَكَرَنِي ذَكَرْتُهُ بِرَحْمَتِي. The one who remembers me, I remember them with my mercy. Look at the chain. Where do we end up? God's mercy. Where do we start? A thought. A simple thought. A simple moment of reflection, maybe a moment that if I can kind of, you know, paraphrase, that you know what, I'm done making a mistake, I'm done denying God, I want to move towards God. That's a qasd, right? That's the shart, as Imam Khomeini says in his first hadith in his chail hadith of jihad of the self, he says, musharata, muraqiba, muhasiba. Do that shart, do that condition. You wake up in the morning, and you say, you know what, I'm not going to break Allah's commands. That has to be there. You have to have a talk with yourself, and then you go out, and you do muraqiba, and you fight shaitan, and you go up and down with shaitan, back and forth, round after round. You win round one, I win round two. That's how it goes. And then you do muhasabah. But that initial conversation with ourselves has to be there. That's why I said yesterday, sometimes it's okay to be uncomfortable. Sometimes it's okay to sit there on the musalla and say, God, I haven't been the best servant to you. But you have to say it with the viewpoint that I know that He listens to me, He answers me. أُجِيبُ دَعْوَةِ دَاعِي إِذَا دَعَانْ سُرِ بَقْرَةً I answer the da'i whenever they call me. Whenever they call me. If months pass and someone like me is ghafil towards him, heedless towards him, I forget him, I get caught up in the dunya, chasing the dunya, I forget about this, my salat becomes lax, this and that. All of a sudden now I have a moment in Muharram where my heart softens, I turn to him. We have to have that yaqeen because he's given us a reason to believe that's exactly what will happen, is that when I call upon him, he won't slam the door in my face. Oh, now all of a sudden you remember me? 6 months have passed? 6 years have passed? No. All from a moment of thought, and now the train begins. From this desire, from this ma'rifat, from finding me, from looking for me, from remembering me, and ultimately what we all want, attaining his mercy. All from a seed of thought, guys. That's powerful.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Adi Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image. then place the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and along with me sitting in the studio, Sister Asma and Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Sister Asma, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, and once more, I'm glad to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The pleasure is always ours to have you both actually back in the studio criticizing some of the movies with religious themes. It's quite a while, actually. We've been talking about the movie Dune, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And before me asking you, again, some questions regarding some of the parts of this movie, let's take a listen to a short part of this movie, Dune, and then we'll be back, continue our program and our critique of that part. Stay with us.
The largest and most dangerous organism on Arrakis is the sandworm, capable of reaching 400 meters in length. To avoid making rhythmic noises which attract the sandworms, the Fremen cross desert spaces using the sandwalk, a dance-like motion with irregular rhythm which emulates the natural sounds of the desert. What scant plant life exists on Arrakis is thanks to the Fremen, who have cultivated deep-rooted tyrannic plants such as saguaro, burrow bush, sand verbena, and incense bush. The shepherd's tree has the deepest documented roots, stretching more than 450 feet deep. These plants cling to life in a parched, nutrient-poor landscape.
Back to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We are trying to criticize the movie Dune, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. I'm going to ask you, Sister Asma, about, let's say, this part of the movie. They are talking about the sandworm. We all know, having watched the movie, everybody knows and he'll understand that, or she'll understand that this is the largest or the most dangerous creature or organism on Arrakis.
Yes.
Right? And that is what they refer to as Shai Halud, mm-hmm. right? And they are sensitive to noises and eat or swallow whatever moves.
Yes, yes.
On the sand. So what's the role of the sandworms or Shai Halud? What do they represent in this movie? Mm-hmm.
Well, in my perspective, I would say that those sandworms are about to represent the natural reaction of the earth against the oppressors. Mm-hmm. As you have watched a movie, you saw that the local people of that place, of Arrakis, have no problem with those sandworms because they've learned how to come in good terms with those creatures. They have learned how to walk in a way, there was a special dance or whatever mm-hmm. for that, yes. in order to cross those deserts without any terrible. Mm-hmm. So they had no problem with it.
Yes.
They came to have this connection with that place that there was no more a fear for them. So they knew how to live with them. But for the strangers who came to that place for the benefit of the earth, those sandworms acted like the power of the earth to react against them. Mm-hmm. And to actually terrify them in order not to take the spice from the local people of the Arrakis,
mm-hmm.
I guess so.
Sayyid Abdullah, do you think that somehow represents or somehow gives a hint at one of the catch-22s available in the desert of the Middle East normally? Like, I'm talking about the climate
change and the consequence as a result of it, like the sand storm mm-hmm. instead of the sand worm, right? Does it really refer to that or not?
It could be. I mean, it's the thing with that creature itself, it represents many things. So it depends on how you look at it. Like the mm-hmm. sister said, it could represent, right. The fact that they use the deserts and stuff like that. You can look at it from the perspective that it could relate to sandstorms. It could relate to the fact because initially the sandworm itself, it produces that spice.
Yes.
So it could be referring to the fact that it's oil itself. You know what I mean. So
yes. The power of the oil is turning against them.
So yeah, basically, not turning against them in a sense, but they shouldn't be getting it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like the people of Iraq, as they are more, it belongs to them more than anyone else. That's mm-hmm. why they are in tune with it. They can ride it, like they can ride the wave. But when it comes to others who want to take it away,
They're not welcome. They're
not welcome. So that worm comes and swallows all the machines mm-hmm. because it's not meant to be theirs. So they're not meant to harvest any spice that's being produced by that worm itself. So Even when they refer to it as Shahulud, or in Arabic, Shay al-Khulud, is in the Khulud, something that eternal, is something that you would use that suffice you. You know what I mean? So that you can.
What
you
was
can,
the first part? Shay in Arabic?
Shay al-Khulud.
Shay, like thing.
Thing uh-huh. of, yeah, thingy, even the naming yeah. itself, thing of eternity. So it's meant to be for the people themselves, not meant to be for the others to come and harvest and take for themselves.
Right.
So like I said, it depends on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. It would give you, like, from whatever angle you look at it, it will give you a different meaning.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to another part of the movie, June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Bless the maker and his water. Bless the coming and going of him. May his passage cleanse the world and keep the world for his people.
Back to the program. Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we are continuing our program Viewpoint with our guest, Sister Asma, and Brother Sayyid Abdullah. We are criticizing the movie June. There is this part, Sayyid Abdullah, that the ecologist in the movie, Dr. Kynes, mm-hmm. that woman,
yeah.
right? Says, bless the maker and his water. Bless the coming and going of him. May his passage cleanse the world and keep the world for his people.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like rhythmic, like a piece of poem or something.
Yeah.
You know? What is she meant by that? I mean, like when one of their refineries is swallowed by the sandworm? When she says it, it's exactly concurrent with that part of the movie, you know?
Yeah, because that lady herself, she's looking at Shah Khulud to be something divine,
mm-hmm.
right? So even at the end when she died,
right,
she was very happy that she was being swallowed by that thing herself.
Yeah, exactly.
So she looked at this creature
mm-hmm.
as something divine, as something that gives them purpose, right. that gives them life.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you talk about water, you talk about life itself.
Right.
The essence of this whole world is water. Even the Quran says, like, we created everything from water. So she refers to it as the life of this entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
So when she's supplicating and doing this dua or munajat or whatever you want to call it, it's trying to highlight the importance of that creature. So to them, it's everything.
Mm-hmm. But she says, bless the maker with a capital M, obviously, and mm-hmm. his water. And we all know that water is so precious on desert.
Yeah.
On right? Arrakis, yes.
All right.
So, but they worship him. They worship those sandworms. They consider him as their gods, right?
Do they?
Yes, they worshiped him.
They did give a hint that it's a worshipped creature. Uh-huh. But I don't think, I do think that in the movie they made it clear that there's a higher being. But that creature, either a manifestation of that god himself or whatever. But they gave a sense of divinity to that creature.
What about like a sense of punishment from something of a higher realm? Like what we call as God, right? Whenever you do something bad, like in the past, people, mythologically speaking, they call, for example, the thunderstorm or lightning as the anger of God, the wrath of God, right? So that was their accounting. That was their explanation. Yeah, so
that's what I said. They gave it a bit of divinity. So being a holy creature itself means it stems its holiness from the maker himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they worship it. I mean, we do the same thing as well. So, for example, when you look at the prophets, when you look at the imam, when you look at holy things,
yes,
we look at them as very holy, divine things because they are made by the maker.
Right.
The maker gave them whatever they have. So we kind of get attached to them as well in the same in the same way that these guys got attached to these creatures.
Yes, true.
And they are, these sandworms are the guardians of that place as well.
Yes.
Because they're protecting from the strangers.
Yes. And something quite noticeable from this movie, Sister Asma, is that the women mostly in the movie are in veil, the black chador.
Yes.
Sort of, you know, in particular. Is that a coincidence or they wanted to like reflect something or get a message across? What was that?
Well, as I said, of course it is not a coincidence and it was not happening by chance. Since they're talking about the Arrakis, they're referring perhaps to the people of that place, but the Bene Gesserit, the women group that they had, they were a special group that were all women who had some superhuman physical and mental powers.
Yes.
So these women, usually, according to, if we talk about the Middle East, these women are veiled and they have special dressings. So I guess they're trying to refer to a special group of people.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. But you know that, you know, you can't find it like in all of the Islamic countries, like the black chador is somehow representative of or typical of certain country or a few countries, basically.
Yes, I told the Arrakis, since they are talking about the Arrakis, so if we consider Arrakis as equal to Iraq, then we could say that they are referring to people up there, the way they dress.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that. I mean, like the veil itself. I mean, if you cross history, cross religions, every single religion believes in the veil. For example, Christianity, veil is compulsory in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Bible says if a woman does not wear a veil, shave her head off.
Yes.
Shave her head off. And by the way, the Jews themselves,
if you go to the nunneries, you see that nuns actually nuns in the
wearing,
veil, right?
Wearing a veil. The Jews themselves, actually the Jews are very extreme, even more than the Muslims. The woman has to cover her entire body and face.
Mm-hmm.
Like the actual Jews, if you Google them, their entire face is covered. Like they have the burqa and even their eyes are not showing. Like they have to have this kind of shield on their faces. Right. So, and even if you go back, you know, if you go back to the any kind of religion with a history to it, they have the veil as part of it. Even if you go back to the late, I don't know, like if you go back to the late 60s, 70s and 50s and you move up, women were more covered than now.
Mm-hmm.
So, and black itself, it is considered to be one of these things that does not attract attention.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I would say that metaphorically, this black veil adds to the mysterious aspect of those creatures.
True, indeed.
Those women were so mysterious, and they were sort of
oracles. And mystics, by the
way. Mysticism, yes. Maybe that was also metaphorically a hint for
them. Yeah, so they want to make sure that, like, usually when they talk about women and women in veil, that nothing, so like I'm talking about the color black, nothing that attracts. So that gives a sense of purity.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
If she wears colors and stuff like that, she attracts attention. She's attracting attention from men or from people and saying, oh, you know what, look at me, stuff like that. So that kind of pollutes her purity.
Right.
So black, especially when it comes to women, is considered to be like the...
Like the white color for males.
Yeah, so it's something that looked at as something that is like a woman in dress code to be in black.
I see.
it's like the best form for her to be in.
Okay, thank you very much, Sister Asma and Sayyid Abdullah, for your nice contribution to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We try to criticize the movie June, produced in 2021, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And hopefully we are going to continue the critique of this movie in the upcoming episode. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Defensive Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
The International Monetary Fund's latest World Economic Outlook forecasts that Iran's economy will experience positive growth in 2022 for the third year in a row, in spite of tough sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran and the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic. The IMF also anticipated that Iran's inflation rate and balance of its current accounts will improve in the current year. The international body had put Iran's inflation rate in 2021 at 40.1%, adding that not only Iran's inflation rate will not increase in the current year as compared to a year earlier, but also it will hit 40% in general, showing a bit of improvement. Nonetheless, the state of Iran's economy is one of the main forces propelling Iranians into the streets these days, socio-political experts say. A sense of disillusionment over the failure of conservative administrations to improve the economy has been a factor in unifying the government's opponents and supporters inside the country. Ordinary citizens denounce the recent riots, street vandalism, and the illegal U.S. sanctions, but say that the majority of Iranians, regardless of their political views, are concerned about their livelihoods today and for their children's future. For an analysis of the state of the Islamic Republic's economy in resisting U.S. sanctions, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. Decades of inhumane U.S.-led sanctions aimed at Iranian people and government, along with the impact of a pandemic compounded by internal mismanagement and corruption, have hindered Iran's economy in terms of growth and progress. Some 655 Iranian entities and individuals were sanctioned under the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama, according to the Center for New American Security. But the most brutal punishment kicked off in 2018 after Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal with world powers, and as a result, Iran's banks were cut off from the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication system.
Life under sanctions makes the country that is under it try to find alternative ways and use creativity. This happened, and the U.S. had the idea during the Obama era that the Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton, said that we imposed paralyzing sanctions on Iran. Apparently, she was the one paralyzed, and the sanctions could not paralyze Iran. It has made it hard, it has made it difficult, but it never reached the level of paralyzing. And the growth of our economy and the growth of our production is the testimony. Of course, let me tell you that our last decade consisted of very little growth, growth of 0.4%. But during the last year, we saw a growth of 3.7%, and in the months that have passed so far this year, we saw a growth of 4.7%. This shows that Mr. Raisi's government was able to take important steps in the country's economic growth. Recently, the International Monetary Fund announced Iran's rank in the world economy at 21st place, and while it had been announced previously, we were downgraded to 28th place at one point. So this shows that Iran's economy has improved.
No sector of Iran's economy was spurred by Washington's punitive measures, which forced the country into a two-year recession and continue to impact every aspect of day-to-day life of the Iranian people. Today, all of those sanctions are still enforced by the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. Ultimately, the Trump administration targeted Iran's economy with more than 960 sanctions that continued endlessly as Iran's healthcare system was severely impacted under the most brutal waves of COVID-19 infections seen in West Asia. And despite appeals by world leaders to offer Tehran a temporary respite for humanitarian reasons. In the face of new sanctions, Iran's leaders remained defiant, introducing the doctrine of resistance economy that would make the country more self-sufficient and less reliant on imports and oil sales. The government invested in domestic industries, urging Iranians to buy local. It also continued to get around the sanctions by selling its oil to international buyers at a discounted rate.
In terms of international trade, in addition to the growth of non-oil exports, we also had growth in oil exports, which had several very specific reasons. We used policies that let us actually sell more oil and turn it into petroleum products, the same policy that was used in neutralizing sanctions. And with this act, we turned oil into products that cannot be embargoed. With this policy of having an overseas refinery, our main discussion was that we cannot sell oil now, so instead we should try to export technical engineering services related to refinery equipment. Since 2018, when we were subjected to heavy sanctions, the United States wanted to cripple us through the gasoline embargo, but our actions and their continuation in the last decade caused us to become self-sufficient in many refinery equipments, and we actually reached a place where we export technical engineering services today to countries like Venezuela, Uzbekistan, or Syria. This means that these countries have inactive or semi-active refineries, which we will first use our services to bring them to full capacity. And through this process, our oil is also sold.
Despite the unprecedented pressure imposed on a country in modern history, Iran is still considered as one of the world's largest economies. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, in its latest report indicated Iran has the 21st largest economy in the world, announcing that in effect 171 countries in the world have a smaller economy than Iran in 2022.
One of Mr. Raisi's achievements is the relative stability of the exchange rate. When his government started working, the dollar price in the open market was 28,000 tomans. During the past year, this has reached 32 to 33,000. It means that the price has increased by 15 to 17%. This is while our inflation has been 40%. That means if we would have grown in line with inflation, the current rate would be much higher than this. This is a sign of relative stability because we cannot freeze the exchange rate by force. This point is very important. The exchange rate should be adjusted according to the needs of export and import with inflationary conditions. Of course, as long as inflation is controlled, we'll see more stability in the exchange rate.
Measures taken, consistent with the resistance economy doctrine, helped the country grow 4.7% in 2021, according to recent World Bank data. Furthermore, as stated in the latest IMF report, it is expected that Iran's GDP will reach $1,599 billion in the current year, based on the Purchasing Power Index, the rate of which will increase by $150 billion as compared to last year. Additionally, the IMF statistics indicated that Iran's economy is now twice as large as some of the Western European economies, such as Switzerland, Sweden, Austria, and Ireland.
In my opinion, what's happening in Iran's economy is this. When you say that the amount of tax revenues has increased by more than 60% compared to last year, when you say that our oil sales have increased 8 times, and when you say that our non-oil exports are going through a growing trend, this means that the source of government funding for current annual budget has changed.
Having proven more resilient and diversified than some predicted, Iran's economy started to return to growth last year, thanks to an easing of cross-border trade, COVID-19